podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Tony Review system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
This is Tor Moments in Time, a series of audio documentaries where we bring you eyewitness accounts of key moments in Liverpool Football Club's history. This time we go back to Saturday the 6th of November 1982 and to Goodison Park for a derby victory Liverpool fans still sing about today. The story is narrated by me, John Gibbons, for the Anfield Rap. One man who knows all about the importance of a Merseyside derby is Kirby-born Phil Thompson. He graduated from the Kop as a boy to end up captaining Liverpool Football Club. He later worked as a coach and assistant manager under Gerard Houllier.
The derby game was the biggest game of the season, always. It wasn't a Manchester United game for me, as some people wish, but being a local lad, the derby games was always massive. It was always nervous. It was always nerve-wracking. It was good rivalry, good banter, but massive. It's like unwritten rules as Liverpool footballers, which got handed down. It's like somebody who did a little book, little red book, which got passed down of all the rules and regulations of what you have to do when you're a player, and you have to get together and you have to mix and you have to do certain things. A derby game was a derby game, and it was massive. And having the likes of Smithy there to influence me, and I then passed that down as I became more of a regular in the side, and certainly more when you became captain and trying to pass on that importance of it.
One young player being taught about the importance of the derby was 21-year-old Ian Rush, although Ian had his own motivations to beat Everton too.
It takes you about two or three derbies to get into it, to know what it's all about, because sometimes you think it's just another game, but it's not. No, it's a special game. And I was lucky enough, I had Phil Thompson, Sammy Lee, Terry McDermott, I had all these scousers who were, you know, driving into me saying this is not a normal game, this is a game for the fans. You know, this is what they think about all year. You know, these fans are, you know, you've got to get one over your rivals. Then I realised what it was all about. And when you see when you score and you see the supporters, how excited they get, for me, there's nothing better. I don't know if people knew that, but as a kid, I was an Everton supporter. I remember one day I was playing for Chester and Gordon Lee was the Everton manager, and he came to watch me, and I have to say, I most probably didn't have the best of games, but I'll never forget on the Monday, he was saying, no, Ian Rush was not for Everton, you know, and I was really devastated, really, because I would have went straight away to Everton, but 3 months later, I signed for Liverpool. The first thing in my mind was payback time, and I just got confident in when I played against Everton. I was so desperate to do well against them that drove me on.
European Cup hero Alan Kennedy played in 12 Merseyside derbies, including this one.
I think there was more tension in those games than any other games, particularly from the fans as well and from the players. You know, I was always thinking to myself, just do your best in this particular game, because you're representing all of Liverpool. They were close affairs, generally 1-0. I remember the first one I played in was 78 when Andy King scored the winning goal in that, and we were on a good run at the time. We were playing really good football. We were going to win the first division title at that particular time, but Everton beat us, and they were quite buoyant about it. Can I just say that? But they were always good close affairs, and Liverpool as a football club looked forward to the derbies probably more than any other game.
Bruce Grobbelaar was in his second year as a Liverpool player, but was already learning about what the city was like in Derby Week.
You don't want to be on the losing side in Merseyside ever, whichever side you're on, because you can't go shopping for about a week afterwards. Until the very next game, you can't go shopping in town, you can't even anywhere in this area. You go to Chester, maybe. Building up to it is, you know, the week before and the week after. A week before, you try and lay low. And at that time, I was living in West Derby. And my door for the whole of that week was getting knocked on by young Evertonian kids. So you must imagine that, you know. I used to go and sit next door with my mates and let whoever was in the house deal with the nutters. Things put through the letterbox, you're going to lose 5-0, you're going to lose tomorrow. Things like that. Friday night, come and whistle, you know, whistling by your window at 2 o'clock in the morning when the pubs are shut. So that sort of thing that you have to adapt yourselves to.
Of course, it was a massive game for the Everton players too. Graham Shaw played 322 times for the Blues.
Well, they were massive. And, you know, listen, I came down from Scotland and obviously growing up with Rangers and Celtic, that was a derby everybody talked about up in Scotland. But when I came down here and people were talking about the Merseyside derby, I was like, nah, it won't be that good. It can't be as good as that. But, you know, I played my first one. It was at Goodison, Liverpool 1-3-1, but everybody spoke that week about it and how big it was and for the supporters and everything else, and how you, if you lost, you couldn't go out and things like that. And all of a sudden, I had so many so-called relations who lived in Liverpool who were wanting to black tickets and everything else, long-lost uncles, not. But no, right away when you were down here, you were made aware how much it meant to the supporters of both sides, obviously. So the first one I played in, I thought, wow, this is incredible, the noise. It was at Goodison. As I said, Liverpool 1-3-1. I managed to score. But the noise, especially when you come out the tunnel at the beginning, for the first 10 minutes, you couldn't hear your teammates shouting at you. So it was an incredible atmosphere. And obviously I played in many after that, but certainly the first one was an eye-opener for me.
Writer Tony Evans has written two books on Liverpool and Everton in the 1980s.
I mean, the thing was, derbies were battles. Talking to Craig Johnson about it for the books, he said, you know, derbies were meatier. He says, you know, you tried to hurt each other. He says, you know, people won't, you know, don't want to say it now, but you did. And while they were all mates, largely, they didn't want to be beaten by the mates. And again, talking to Lawrenson for the books, he said, like, you'd have a car with your name on. He said, you didn't drive it the week leading up to the derby. And if you got beat, no chance. He said, you'd borrow your wife's car. It was like that. So they were intense.
Brian Reid was a young journalist working in Reading at the time, although he travelled back to Liverpool for the match.
I think that day, I think Evertonians sensed the room for a bit of hiding because there seems to be loads of spare tickets going around. So, yeah, I got one and very, very memorable day there. We'd had a mixed start to the season. We were top by about a point, maybe two. And I think just before then, October had been a bad month. I think we lost at West Ham when we lost at Ipswich. We drew at Stoke. We drew at home to Man United. I think we'd just been Brighton the week before, but it was kind of a 3-1. I'm not convincing. So we were getting to our stride early season. Nobody foresaw what was going to happen that day. And Everton, of course, it is a derby. They can raise a couple of good players you could score against, yeah. So no, I wouldn't say it was overly confident, no. But definitely quietly.
For first team coach Roy Evans, preparation was all about keeping the team calm and focused.
Well, we always thought if you had to motivate any players for a derby match, then they're in the wrong sport and they should be doing something else. We were always, if they weren't offered, then you have got a serious problem as a coach or a manager. Yeah, we prepared the same for the derby matches as we would for any other. Obviously, you'd talk about different things and the way Everton played. But as I said, most of all, it was about us and our sessions and how intense we could be. And if you could take it onto the pitch, that we thought we could beat them. We had the ability to do that. So it was never really anything different from other games until it actually started.
Liverpool went into the game top of the league with Everton mid-table, a fact not lost on the Everton players at the time.
Listen, we knew about Liverpool. Liverpool were a fabulous side. We probably went into those games with an inferiority complex because we hadn't won in a long, long time. You know, the 70s was a different era and there were some epic battles in there. But when I first came down, Liverpool were at the pomp.
Writers and season ticket holders Mike Nevin, John Macken and Kev Sampson came together to share their recollections of the day.
The right of Everson, that earlier that season he'd been dropped by Kendall for being overweight. And the headline on the back of the Daily Post, which was the Morning Echo basically, was Billy Bunter. So Everton weren't going into the game on a huge wave of confidence because they had this loney from Blackburn, Keeley, who hadn't played. And then the other guy was Billy Bunter.
And yeah, they also had Brian Burrows, who I'd forgot ever played for them. Steve McMahon was playing for them at this time. And David Johnson had gone back there to sort of see how it's going.
Read out the rest of the team, John, because they had some good players and good players that actually went on to win stuff for them.
Good players up front, yeah. Yeah, Southall in goal, obviously. Yeah. So it was Southall, Burrows, Bailey, Keeley, Wright, and then Steve McMahon, Adrian Heath, David Johnson, Graham Sharp, Andy King, and Kevin Sheedy.
So what sticks in my mind is that back four then, because that looked so
they were just asking to be torn apart.
Ben Keeley's name on the team sheet was a surprise to many, including his teammates.
Well, if I'm honest with you, I think we're all surprised he was actually playing, you know, because he came in loan, and I think he'd only had one, maybe two training sessions with us. Didn't look great in training either. And we were thinking, no, where's he got this one from? This is, I don't know where Howard's been, you know, but he put him in, which is a shock.
I remember Glenn Keeley from my Newcastle days, and we were actually talking in the tunnel, the narrowest of tunnels I've ever been in at Everton, and talking about our Newcastle days. And he seemed all right, he seemed okay, but you can never tell with players sometimes. You know, sometimes they may seem relaxed to you, but inside they're churning up. And this was his first game that I think they'd taken a chance on because they had a problem with the centre halves, and you know, they changed the team around slightly, but he seemed okay, and everybody was up for it actually in the tunnel. You know, all players were ready to get out on the pitch, and so, you know, you don't really want to look sometimes players in the eyes, and sometimes I wasn't the tallest of players, so I'd be looking up at Keeley and thinking he's a big lad, you know, and you're looking up at Graham Sharp. You know, I have to say, it's intimidating in that little tunnel, and you know, we couldn't wait to get onto the pitch.
The Liverpool team in the tunnel that day were Bruce Grobbelaar, Phil Neal, Alan Kennedy, Phil Thompson, Alan Hansen, Craig Johnson, Sammy Lee, Mark Lawrenson, Graeme Souness, and up front, Kenny Dalglish and Ian Rush.
In that tunnel at Goodison, and you can still see it now because it's still the same tunnel. The way we remember Anfield's tunnel, which was a bit wider and not as long, because you come out of the two dressing rooms and you start that long walk down, and then you take a left turn, which is still tight. So you come down there, so you're more or less rubbing shoulders. Those days I was captain. So it was sort of quite important, sort of you rubbing shoulders with them. And it wasn't as sort of angry. You were like that, you may talk to somebody, but once you cross that line, oh my God, I'd have given anything and done anything to get a result against Everton.
Nothing fazed me. I think it's one of them, whoever, you know, played at Wembley, played at Everton, played, you know, Liverpool, anywhere. I just felt my job was to be focused on the game. And yet when you walk out just before the kickoff and everything, yeah, that's the atmosphere. I think you've got to just blank it out. You know, and for me, whether I'm playing in front of 10 people or 100,000 people, my mindset is to do exactly the same. You know, I block everything out and concentrate on the game, and that's what I've done against Everton. But it's only when you're going out and you warm up just before the kickoff, you realise, you know, how intimidating Everton was.
Anfield Rap contributor Rob Gutman moved to Liverpool around that time.
I suppose my first memories of going to Goodison was I was surprised how noisy they could be, because we had the reputation, we had the cop, they were shit, but they were noisy as well. Against us, you know, I think if you go to Goodison any other Saturday, they weren't, but against us, it was an intimidating cauldron, shall we say.
So I was in the enclosure. The enclosure was a brilliant thing because basically it was like, it was sort of half and half, but from the halfway line towards Liverpool end, it was all Liverpool. And in theory, it was unsegregated, but obviously everyone was like,
gravitate towards
your own end. And I'd say that at this game, Liverpool had, it was, I think it was the crowd's about 50,000.
52?
Not I'd that. Say that we had 20,000 of the ground. So basically, you'd have the enclosure up to the halfway line and the paddock, which was the terrace in front of the Bullens Road. That would be up to the halfway line.
Yeah,
as well.
It'd be all red.
Yeah. But you'd have some brave blues who would actually infiltrate our bit and vice versa.
People said when you're a local lad, oh, you know, you never play well in derby games because of the importance of it, the pressure of it, the stress of it. I think I had some of my best ever and greatest ever games in derby matches because I knew how much it actually mattered. And you try to impress that on other people. So this game was no different. So you made sure that everybody was on the toes, ready, right from as soon as it kicked off. You made statements with your first tackle. It was always in those days, get your first tackle in, rattle them. And it was like referees, you always said, well, you know, they give you the first tackle. So you made sure you made it count.
You've got to take the sting out of the atmosphere. You've got to keep the Goodison faithful quiet. And once you get them quiet, then they'd start to turn on their own side. It was psychological, and it was a battle of wits to try and keep them quiet, which we did.
I think it's always been the way we'd like to play Liverpool. We, obviously, sometimes it doesn't happen that way, but that's, we've always been a team that I believe in. I start the game really well, and you can score, if you can score one or two goals early on, you put obviously the opposition under severe pressure. Again, if you're going to sit back and let them come at you, then you could be the other way around, and then you're in real trouble. So we did like to try and control the game from start to finish, if you like, but that doesn't always happen, of course. But it's nice when it does, and on that day particularly, I think we did more or less control it from start to finish.
Kevin Sampson.
One thing that hasn't changed this day is getting into Goodison. It's just always a saga, you know, no matter how early you start queuing up, it just takes your ages getting in. And I thought that we were already 3-0 up, but there must have been some close run things before we even got our first, because it sounded...
We could have been 2 or 3
outside, you know, just hearing these roars and ooh. And I was amazed when we got in that it was still 0-0.
It wasn't 0-0 for long. Ian Rush scored Liverpool's first goal of the game on 11 minutes, made majestically by Alan Hansen.
I remember Alan Hansen putting it through for the first goal to me. You know, they talk about defenders today. You know, Alan Hansen was an incredible player. He brought the football forward and all. Sometimes he'd be in midfield. You know, and I remember him putting the ball through to me. I ran onto and put it past Neville Southall. I think it may have went through his legs or something like that.
Well, Hansen was incredible in terms of reading the play, and that's what he was good at. And I remember him, I think, intercepting a ball coming through the middle, and then my job then was to cover him because he was going forward, but I found myself drifting into the left side of the midfield. But I watched the run of Ian Rush, and he timed it to perfection. The great ball by Hansen, you know, dissecting the several defenders, played the ball round, and Rushy coolly, calmly put the ball in the back of the net. I can still picture it today, how good he was. And when you're competing against Neville Southall, you know he's not going to show you an easy ride, but Rushy showed how good he was in those days.
Big Al was like that. He came in quite laid back, absolutely fantastic in the air, probably a bit bigger than the rest of us, so he was great. He had a great leap, whereas he did, you know, from a standing leap, could run like the wind, obviously not one of these quick stride people, but a long leggy strides. He was as quick as anybody in the league. But what a footballer. What a footballer. He could step out from the back and play. I don't know whether I was a midfield player before he played to the centre-back. I certainly was a midfield player. So when you had that in your locker, you could step forward and pass the ball, which made it a massive asset, especially when you play for Liverpool FC. And Big Al was some of the best at it. When he strode forward and he went forward like that, he would glide past people. So he was always adept. I knew, and he had license to do that. I would make sure then that we shut the back door. Wherever he'd left that gap, I would ease over. I would get Phil Neal a bit closer and Kennedy a bit closer to allow Big Al to stride forward. He was a Rolls Royce of a player, and he was, and it's no shock that he should create that goal for us.
I don't think we'd seen it in a British football. Well, you know, before my time, they talked about Bobby Moore being the sophisticated defender. I've seen videos. I'm sure he wasn't doing what Hansen was doing. The only other comparable to Hansen was Beckenbauer in Germany, sort of in the previous 8-10 years, where he was meant to be almost like the sweeper role, that he came forward, brought the ball out from the back. And the Italians had a guy called Scirea who played for Juventus, who was meant to be a bit of that. But you know what? There wasn't much foreign footy on TV, so you just took their word for it. Hansen was the one, and he did it routinely, and sometimes he scored some great goals. Fantastic one for 25 yards against Norwich, but it did become a feature of our play and our counter-attacking play.
Wave after wave of Liverpool attack continued. Kenny Dalglish missed a great chance before having a header controversially ruled out for offside.
It was a perfectly good goal. In fact, the linesman didn't flag, and it was a header. I mean, people were running back to the centre circle to take it, and then all of a sudden the linesman puts his flag up. It was weird. Everton bench it onto him, and the referee changed his mind.
It was from one of my one and only crosses that were genuine that particular time. You know, I'd marauded it, as they say, down that left-hand side and got myself into a position of, I'm in open space, and do I carry on or do I try and put the ball into the box early, which sometimes upsets defenders. And I did that, and I found Kenny Dalglish. He felt as though he was onside, and we all felt as though he was onside at that particular time. Whether the linesman was sleeping or whether the referee should have maybe overruled him at that particular time, but that was a key part of it, because like, if they score the next goal, they're right back in it. If we score the next one, then, you know, we're going to run away with it. But, you know, we felt as though that was a it wasn't a turning point, but it was a big point in the game. And we were disappointed we weren't 2-0.
Any luck the Everton defence felt was theirs was short-lived. Kenny Dalglish went through again and Glenn Keely pulled him back. He was sent off by referee Derek Siddle. Graham Beecroft was a sports journalist working in local radio.
He'd been manager of Blackburn Rovers, and Keely, of course, was a Blackburn Rovers player on loan at Everton. So he brought him in, thought he could do a job, but of course it was a derby atmosphere. It's a big ask to ask a player to come in from a club like Blackburn Rovers and play in an atmosphere exactly like that. So it was a big call, and it was a call which didn't come off at all.
Ben, he hadn't played all season. He hadn't played for Blackburn. He was in a wage dispute with them. And Kendall brought him in. He played one reserve game and he said, "I'm playing you." And he went, I'm not fit. He went, "No, you're a big game player." And he threw him in. Keely didn't realise they brought a new law in that summer, the professional foul. You couldn't do professional fouls. He hadn't played. And when he tugged Dalglish back to get sent off, he thought he was going to get a booking.
It was a big thing for him to be playing and thrust in society. He was a big lad, so he'd have a presence. But playing against Rushy, playing against Kenny, it's a massive thing. And you can get turned or you can get a ball behind you. So you always got that difficulties. So when that happened, you went, he did take a gulp. And you can imagine Evertonians going, "Oh my God, what's coming next?" And lo and behold, he went off. And you could see from the Everton players' eyes of the panic, because we were good. And playing against 10 men in a derby game, we could get even better.
Playing against Liverpool with 11 is hard enough, and they're playing against 10 with no chance. And, you know, I wouldn't say that. I think it had a massive bearing on the scoreline. You know, I still think we'd have found it difficult to beat Liverpool. But I think we're down to 10 men we were up against with no chance.
The message at half-time was clear. Keep passing, keep attacking, keep your foot on the pedal.
Bob and Joe and we would have their tactics in their heads, and they didn't want to change much from the back four. They wanted us to consolidate, okay, not to give any chances away. Don't give free kicks away. Don't give them the chance to get back into the game, because 10 men can surprise players as well as 11 men.
The big thing, if I can remember, with the game is keep passing the ball. Not just keep passing the ball, pass it quicker than ever, so that you can displace them, you can move them about. Obviously, that was one of our traits anyway, but to do it when you're playing against these games, when you play against them and you know it's going to be a blanket defence, so what you have to do, you have to move the ball quicker. And that is what happened in that game. It was an exhibition.
Because we had good players at the back who could come out with the ball, and they were sat back there, somebody comes back, whether it be Hansen, come back out the bottom. Lawrenson's coming from midfield. Sammy Lee, I think, was you know, as I say, if you look at all the goals, they're going towards their defence, and there's movement in front of them from our attackers. So, obviously, with that one man short, if you can get the right space and pick it out, which we did on the day, you were always going to win the game. But it's always difficult when you get against 10 men, because everybody expects you to win, first of all, and they go back and make it a tighter defensive setup, if you like. On the day, of course, it didn't work for them.
A lot of games, if you go against 10 men, you become very sloppy. You're having so much of the ball. Big Al, myself, were playing on the halfway line. Literally, they hardly ever got out, because I was the organiser. I would make sure that everybody is in position so they could not get out from the edge of their box. So we, as the guys running around your feet, keep the ball moving side to side to side to side until that chance came in, and it was slipped through.
We found open spaces, and I found myself in quite a few open spaces. I think the right side of the midfielder, you know, drifting back and helping these fullbacks out a little bit, being a bit deeper. But we pushed them back on lots of occasions. And the one thing about people like Alan Hansen and other players, they can run with the ball. And that's exactly what we did. We ran with the ball. We took the ball off them. We broke them down. We then counter-attacked. And when we counter-attack, every player seemed to be going forward. And fortunately, we didn't leave anything at the back, and they struggled to create anything. And it was just a matter of time before we got that second goal.
Liverpool got that second goal on 51 minutes, a deflected strike from Ian Rush.
One of the great things about Rush is that his anticipation was unbelievable, but he hit the ball early as well. And Southall, as good a goalkeeper as he was, he couldn't get set. He did it in the being. And the number of times you see Rush hit the ball and it bubbles in, you know, when the keeper can't get to it, and that's because he hit it early, and he was just a master of that.
Liverpool's third came just 4 minutes later. The goal scorer, do you know it?
That was one of the questions, which, who scored the other goal? Rush scored one, Rush scored two, Rush scored three, Rush scored four. Who scored the other one? Yes, it was Mark Lawrenson. And I think he slides it in. And it was just great. And you could see he wasn't a local lad, but the burn and passion out of Laura when he scored. Mark played at left back. He played at centre back. He played in centre midfield. He was that quick and such a good tackler that he could play in most positions.
Ronnie Whelan was struggling with an injury, I think, that particular game. We had the enigma, but it's a great enigma. Where do we play Mark Lawrenson, such a great player? Where do you play him? Because he played there before. He played against Swansea. He was always a player that could fit into any position. But playing wide on the left-hand side, although he wanted to come in on occasions, and I think you quite see him, the cross comes in from the opposite side, and he's at the far post just ready to poke it into the empty net. And that really was the end of Everton for me. You know, we thought we're going to beat them maybe by a couple more goals. You know, we did feel that. Once we know we've got a team on the rack, you know, we go for the jugular.
The one that sets the atmosphere off completely and where you get this like reverberation of Liverpool around Goodison, which is a brilliant thing, is Lawrenson's goal, which is the third one.
Yeah.
Because it's the way it happens. And Dalglish in that is...
It's a bit like Keegan's goal at Wembley 74.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah,
breaks clear on the edge of the box, the hard low cross and sliding in.
But do you know the most intelligent thing about it at all is it goes out for a throw-in and Dalglish feigns disinterest. And it's like he's switched off. He's doing that ridiculous Dalglish walk, which is a bit like a Scouse walk. He's swinging his shoulders and he's looking like he doesn't give a shit. But he's alive to the fact that someone's going to throw the ball down the line.
Touchline.
And the moment that it's released, he's on it. And next minute he's in.
Yeah.
And then he crosses it. It actually takes a bit of a lucky deflection.
A little deflection.
Yeah.
Just
which sets it up for Lawrenson. And Lawrenson, who's playing in midfield in those days, isn't he?
Yeah.
Slides it in. And it's one of those most emphatic goals you can ever see.
Liverpool's fourth and Ian Rush's hat-trick came on 71 minutes after a pass from Kenny Dalglish, a sight that would become more and more familiar for Liverpool fans.
I think it's one of the days you start to see this great relationship forming with Dalglish and Rush, and you're thinking, we had it with Keegan Toshak, like a different vibe, obviously balls into the big man, knocked down Toshak like in the area, but they had a telepathic thing going. You start to see it that day with Rush and Dalglish. Kenny drops deeper and Rush makes these wonderful runs, times it. Rush could really time his run perfectly to split the defence. He had such good pace on him, and then he hardly had to look up. He had such a good sense. Very good play outside the box, Ian Rush, and obviously inside the box he was, but you started to see the potential that day. And of course, you know, there was other good performances. Craig Johnson played well, but they were the kind of, something was starting to emerge there, which you thought, I mean, don't bear in mind, he's now 82, so how long that lasted, you know. We've got the 86 final 4 years down the line there. Some good years there with Rush and Dalglish.
Liverpool's fifth and Ian Rush's fourth was made by Sammy Lee.
The fourth goal again, I think Sammy Lee put me through. You know, I went round Neville Southall and put it in the back of the net, and it's good for me because the three goals then were in where the Liverpool supporters were. That gave me great satisfaction. But for some reason, Everton kept playing the high line every time there, and it was really easy for me, you know. So I just wait there. When you had people like, you know, Souness, Sammy Lee, Dark Leeds, when they got the ball there, I know I'll hold them because I know they're going to put the ball in that space, and when they put the ball in space, I was going to get on the end of it. I don't know really why Everton played the high in that game.
One of the things I remember most, I remember to the day I die, when we scored the fifth, some bastard kicked me right in the shin. I've still had the lump on my shin, and I was like, who kicked me? No one fronts up to it. I was fuming, even though we'd scored. You know what, though? I think of that Evertonian, and I wonder what he's doing now. When I'm lying there at night sometimes, and I'll rub that little lump and I'll smile, because it reminds me of a great day.
From Liverpool's point of view, it couldn't get much better than that, really. It was a fantastic performance all the way around. And had it not been for a brilliant display by Neville Southall, the scoreline could have easily been greater.
It got to five, and it could have gone on. If there was 10 more minutes, it could have been eight. It was that humiliating for the Everton players and Everton fans.
If
We've had some terrific victories there over the years, but you know, that one, I can remember spending the last, well, not the entire last 10 minutes, but I had my arm around my mate Paul Sundby, who's no longer with us, sadly. Norwegian surname that, but he was from Breck Road. And we were just laughing. We couldn't stop laughing. We had our arms around each other going, I've got to get another hit. I've got to get another look.
The all-rounders play of the team. I mean, we've mentioned it. Rush could have scored six. We could have scored 8 or 9 easily. Mm. No exaggeration.
I'm going to say we could have scored 13.
Okay.
No exaggeration. In clear chances. Yeah. Clear chance. Either brilliant saves, hit in the woodwork, or in the case of Kenny, goals that he would have scored every day of the week and just didn't on that occasion.
Yeah, and when you put all that together into the mix where you're beating your local rivals on their own ground.
And when you think about like Liverpool's most famous song, really, or Liverpool's best song, Poor Scouser Tommy, the fact that it features at the end of it, still my most favourite derby by a mile, because it was just so emphatic.
We were out of sight by an hour.
Yeah, and there was nothing to worry about. It was just great.
But it was interesting because I interviewed Glenn Keely afterwards and he marched down the corridor and I thought, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, I'll ask him about the sending off. I said, what exactly happened there? And he came out with a few expletives and said, I've no idea, basically. But of course, that was the end of the game. And it was the end of his career with Everton, incidentally, as well. So that was that.
I remember they had a player, a former colleague of mine, David Johnson, and he was playing for Everton on that occasion. And he tells me later that he only had 5 touches of the ball and they were all at kickoffs. Because he kicked the ball off 5 times because we scored 5 goals. He said, that's the only time I got a touch of the ball. But that's the way we played it. Later in life, I talked to Howard Kendall about the actual game. He says, well, we couldn't do anything. No matter what we did, we couldn't stop this pressure that Liverpool were putting us under. Liverpool were just superb on the day, and that particular season, we played some of our best football on pitches that weren't fit to put cattle on. That's how bad they were at that particular time, but you had to adjust to it, and certainly Liverpool that day did that. They'll tell me about when they beat Liverpool through a Graham Sharp goal. People will always have memories of derbies, and they are always fast and furious, but they were great, honestly, nerve-wracking things to play, and they must have been even worse for the fans, because you've come out of that game, you've won 5-0, we're at the top of the tree, we're like, our heads are going through the clouds, but the Everton fans, and you meet Everton fans throughout the city, and sometimes they're lucky. You were lucky, weren't you? 5-0 in any game is a great result. You can't call it lucky. You have to make your own luck, and that's what we felt on the day. We were going to make Liverpool the top team on Merseyside. We won the game. That was the be all and end all, was to win the game, and that's what Liverpool did better than any other team.
Could have been any dressing room after any victory against Everton. It was absolutely buzzing because the staff were the same. They knew the importance of it. Ron Hill always had us fired up for it. Joe in a little bit of a calmer way, so you had a good blend. So it was massive. We were in there afterwards. Bob was delighted. But the players, it was such a big game, and I knew the importance. I remember the 60s when we got beat 4-0 by Everton at Anfield, and it was absolutely always played in my mind. And to make a scoreline like that at Goodison was huge. It would be one, and we're still talking about it now.
Well, you do in those days as well. You used to go to the players' lounge, and Liverpool lads would be in the players' lounge as well. The Everton lads and the families, kind of thing. So, listen, we all got on great off the field. We saw each other out in Southport and got on well. But it's hard to take, when you get in there as well, and all your family are down the expectations, and it's like, wow, you just go into the dressing room, and dressing rooms are amazingly quiet. Nobody wants to talk. Howard Kendall would have come in and said a few things that I don't think even went mad as much, but it was a case of, listen, you've let yourselves down and you've let the supporters down. You've got to go on with it now. You've got to go home, dust yourself off, come to work on Monday and get on with it, you know. And it's hard, and even though you try and put it to one, you can't, because everybody's, especially I've seen Liverpool supporters in the traffic or whatever, they're making sure you remember about it. So they were great games to play, and don't get me wrong, they were great games to play in, but when you lost, it was really difficult. But in those days, they had so many, you know, outstanding players. You know, they had the majority of possession. We talk about Manchester City now and the way they pass it. Liverpool done that many years ago, and it was difficult to get the ball off them. So we had to try and draw them in to like a physical battle. But in saying that as well, you know, they had physical players as well, so they could mix it as well. So they had everything, you know, so it was really difficult to get after them, if you like. It was only until later on when we felt as if we maybe could match them. But certainly in the early days, in my early days, you went over there and you weren't really... Listen, your fans expected you to win, don't get me wrong, but, you know, I think the club and the players didn't have that confidence to go out there and maybe upset Liverpool, and it was difficult times for Everton.
Everyone remembers the John Watson commentary where he said all of Liverpool's superiority over Everton over the previous year seemed to be encapsulated in one afternoon. It was on Match of the Day that night, and I think any Liverpool fan who had a VHS recorded it, and I had that. Do you know what? I might even have that tape somewhere in my basement, just because I watched it over and over again.
Ian Rush might have been the hero, but he still had to worry about how he was going to get home.
I lived in Flint, which travel every day to Liverpool, and funny enough, just before that, I had a six-month driving ban, and Kevin Ratcliffe, who was playing for Everton at the time, used to take me into work. You know, he used to drive me into work, and I'd get the train back home from training, but on match day, he dropped me off at Anfield. You know, I went pre-match at Anfield, and really, he went to Goodison, and it's funny enough, I was asking for a lift back home, and he said yes. I'll never forget it, in the players' lounge after, I was there with the ball under my arm, and Kevin wasn't speaking to me, and we came out, and we're about 200 yards walk to Kevin's car, and there's six Evertonians coming, and I was thinking, oh, I'm in trouble here, and they never said a word to me. They just hammered Kevin Ratcliffe. I just legged it to the car then, you know, and it was one of them things, and you know, Kevin's never forgiven me then. Then I was very young those days. Like, I was just normal for me. You know, I was just one of them. I was just one normal. Suddenly, as you get older, you realise you've got to take it all in. But I want to improve myself all the time. But you know, it's always great. You go out in the evening and you have a great night and everything, and you're still on high on a Sunday morning. You know, I was in Wales. You know, I used to go and watch my brothers play football on a Sunday morning in Wales. After that, and then I'd go to the pub at 12 o'clock, and the locals, a lot of them were Everton supporters as well. You know, and I'd have a drink, and we'll have a laugh and a joke between each other and everything. And it was weird, because very weird again, because I'll never forget Bob Paisley said to me before the game, I think he said, do you know no one scored a hat-trick in the Merseyside derby in about 30-40 years? And I just thought, well, why is he telling me that? And it was weirdly enough, you know, I scored 4 goals, and he said, I knew you were going to score a hat-trick. You know, that's how good Bob Paisley was, and that's how much confidence he gave me going out in that particular game.
I used to go with a load of lads from Breck Road in them days, and we went back to the route was the old barn, then the George corner, yeah. Then we jumped the number 14 into town, we went to the Harrington Bar, and ooh, the yes. Newly opened State.
Wow. Oh my God.
The State had only been open a matter of weeks by then. Yeah.
And those are the days, Kev.
Yes. Yeah. How about that, 5-0 and ended up in the State.
Yeah. In a State.
Well, that goes without saying, yeah, doesn't course, it? Yeah.
I was back in Walton Village in the coffee house, and the bar in there was just like half reds and half blues, and they even hung around to watch it on Match of the Day. I think they were just completely shocked, wanted to make sure it actually happened.
Funny enough, that night I remember going to town, and there wasn't a great deal of animosity as to well, you'd worry later on, wouldn't you, if Liverpool won 5-0 now, what kind of kickings off would go on. And I remember at the time Eddie Grant had a song out called I Don't Wanna Dance, and I think we were in either the Globe or the White Star, and these Evertonians sitting on their own were singing I don't wanna play Liverpool no more, the future looks bad, the future looks bad. And we thought, well, yeah, that's quite good. It's one of those that, you know, didn't expect anything was really coming. It was a derby, loads of derbies, aren't there? But obviously it went down to folklore, because it was the birth of one of our great superstars, really. You know, Ian Rush, quite an underrated player to an extent. You know, people, because Dalglish, I mean, how'd you outshine Dalglish? You know, he was everything, wasn't he? But Rush was... She was so integral to that team in the 80s. It reminded me a lot of Roger Hunt. I mean, Roger Hunt obviously got the credit, but, you know, Ian St. John was my first hero. It wasn't Roger for some reason. St. John had more charisma. Dalglish had more charisma. But Ian Rush was just such a fantastic player and so reliable. You know, you just knew he could pop up and score, make something out of nothing. And as I say, he could head it as well. He could do it all. Because he was such a quiet lad as well, he didn't want to speak much. He didn't he really blew his trumpet. And he was the object of all the piss takes in that team. So he kind of, you know, he knew his role. And again, that was part of that Liverpool team. Then nobody could get big, you know, only Kenny.
We talk about all the Liverpool players of the present day. They've got some way to go to match what Rush has done. You know, he's a fantastic footballer, scored all types of goals, had a fantastic relationship with Kenny Dalglish. Kenny dropped out the side and moved on. Peter Beardsley came in and an understanding there. So he was a very clever footballer, Rushy. You know, always on the shoulder of defenders. Kevin Ratcliffe was his big mate. Never could get the better of him. Rushy scored for fun against Rats. And Neville Southall as well, who was a really good goalkeeper. But every time you saw Rushy going through one and one, 9 times out of 10 was only one outcome and he was going to score. He had everything.
It turned him into a cop hero forever, you know. Even if he would never have kicked a ball afterwards, he'd, you know, people would still be singing about that day because it was brilliant. You could see he was something special by then, you know, and you were just looking forward to hoping he could continue as, you know, his upward trajectory. But that day told you that he was around for, you know, such a long time, and you saw that we had a goal scorer to be feared. And I'll tell you what, he punished Everton, didn't he? Not only that day, but every possible chance he got, he made them suffer.
He was unstoppable, and he was so sort of such a shy lad in a lot of ways that he just got on with his job, took the adulation, took the accolades very, very well, didn't let that sort of get to him too much. And he was so clever on a football pitch. And I think that's what made him so special. But Rushy was so difficult to mark. What did you want? He could score left foot, right foot. At times, you went, what's his natural foot? It was that difficult when you see his volume with his left foot, volume with his right foot. You went, wow. He could do everything. Tap-ins, shots from outside the box. He had an array of talent to be sort of... He's probably the best goal scorer in the world at his particular time. And he was playing for Liverpool, which made it even better.
My job was to score goals. If I scored one, I want to score two. If I scored two, I want to score three. It's made bread and butter. And I scored, when I scored four, I want to score five. And that's what it's all about. But it's funny when you finish playing football, you look back and see what an achievement it was. When you're playing, you think, okay, you've got to do it again. But I can look back and now and say, with pride, you know, no, I scored four goals against Everton in the Merseyside derby. You know, not many people have done that. No, so for me, it's something which I'll always remember.
And it's something Liverpool fans will always remember, as long as there's a certain song that's sung on the cup.
When I go to Liverpool now, obviously being an ambassador for Liverpool, but I think now is I go as a supporter. And when they sing that, it just brings tears to your eyes, really. You know, I think people that most probably didn't even see the goals, you know, I think the older generation will be doing that. The younger generation, for them to still sing that is something very, very moving. You know, obviously, again, man, you'll never walk alone. That's incredible. When they sing that, for me, it's just, I can't believe it, you know, and I feel so proud and everything. And hopefully it continues because it gives me a great pleasure when they do sing the name.
Tour Moments in Time is produced by myself and Josh Sexton with support from everyone at the Anfield Rap. Huge thanks to everyone who contributed to this episode. In order of appearance, Phil Thompson, Ian Rush, Alan Kennedy, Bruce Bobolar, Graham Sharp, Tony Evans, Brian Reid, Roy Evans, Mike Nevin, John Macken, Kevin Sampson, Rob Gutman and Graham Beecroft. We are able to produce these documentaries thanks to the people who pay monthly for our subscription service. So big thanks if ever if you are one of those people. If you want to subscribe to Tour Player, just visit theanfieldrap.com. We'd love you to join us. Up the Reds, all you need is Rush.
Thank you for listening to the Anfield Rap. Listen, you're probably going to get bored of this over the next few weeks. We're putting this at the end of every show. It's Neil Atkinson here, whether I hosted this show or not. To ask you to vote for us in the British Podcast Awards, to do that you go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote, and there you'll find it is the Listener's Choice Award, supported by BBC Sounds. If you search for the Anfield Rap in the box that comes up, you will get the Anfield Rap, or TAW also gets us the Anfield Rap as well. So TAW gets us the Anfield Rap, or the Anfield Rap in there. And then from there, if you vote for us, you'll then get an email that you'll have to click to confirm the vote. And then from there, you've registered the vote, and we appreciate it very much. We've never won this award in the British Podcast Award. We've come second 3 consecutive years. We discovered that last season we were a little bit closer than we thought last season, last year. Good Lord, not everything works like that, Neil. And so we thought, well, let's give it a real go. We'll give it a big push this time out. So hopefully you've been able to do that for us, and hopefully you're happy to do so as well. We do always appreciate the support in any way in which it comes at the Anfield Wrap, and especially through what's obviously been a difficult time for a number of podcasts for obvious reasons. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, and take care. Sports Social Podcast Network.